Stay tuned for The Turning Point. So what did Buddha say? Buddha said, you know what, let's turn the microphone up a little bit more. I mean, the headphones. Yeah, that's good right there. So Buddha said that life is suffering. And what is the cause of this suffering or sorrow? It's attachment, grasping behavior, attachment to something, especially anything that is changeable or ephemeral or superficial. And that describes a great deal of life, right? Especially, I can't say modern life. I mean, who knows what culture was like back then. And then, yeah, that's what Mr. Buddha said. It's grasping and it's trying to get that golden ring every minute, to try to, you know, strike it rich every second, and to cash in to cash in on anything at any time, any means to an end. So we have this article that was in the paper the other day, a couple of days ago. The headline is "Rich Casino Plan, But No Sure Thing for Cuomo." It's about the governor of New York State who has to make some really very difficult choices between raising state taxes. The state has tremendous unemployment upstate New York. Tax base is very, very inadequate to meet all the educational and repair needs of the state. It's really, you know, it's as bad as many other states or worse. And there's New York State is considering options now on whether it should have a huge Las Vegas-style casino. And the leading proponent for this, to build this, is a Malaysian group, a conglomerate called the Genting Group. Who knows? Believe me. There is no way of knowing who this group is and what they are. And I don't want to libel anybody, but these places in the Far East, and especially think of Sheldon Adelson, these places are notoriously corrupt when it comes to bribing places like this, I should say, you know, because I don't want to get in any trouble here. And I'm sure that the Gently group is listening to every word I say. I'm sure of it. Anyhow, they are famous for bribing officials, corrupting entire governments, state governments, and even countries' governments to control gambling. And they don't put up with any competition. Just leave it at that. You know, the way they deal with competition is a way you might be familiar with if you saw The Godfather. So here, it's in Tuxedo, New York. Funny name, right? Tuxedo, New York is a beautiful upstate place surrounded by a state forest, beautiful forest. And here it says, here on an old landing strip carved out of a hillside in a dense forest only 44 miles northwest of Manhattan, in an hour or less than an hour's drive, this company is seeking to build an eye-popping complex with 1,000 hotel rooms and over-the-top entertainment for every taste and season. Theaters, restaurants, ski runs, formal gardens, zip lines, whatever that is, even a refurbished Renaissance village. And I'm going to skip through this article because it's a long article. This could generate tremendous amount of upstate taxes. It could generate state and local taxes of $400 million, which would be a tremendous boon to New York State. And it can also create thousands and thousands of jobs in the casino, serving the people who serve at the who work at the casino. There would be buildings built for people who wanted to live up there. Some of the people who work in the casinos make minimum wage. Some of them make tremendous amounts of money. The dealers and other people, well, tremendous, but you know, they make good money. Casino managers, janitorial people who, you know, serve the work in the restaurants, who clean the hotel rooms, who manage the hotel, lots and lots of jobs for a place that has been poor for decades and then have no jobs whatsoever. So it's a good thing as far as the money goes. I'm skipping ahead in this article. Conservationists, however, right away you say, oh, right, there they are again, the ones who want to save the spotted, you know, titmouse eagle bird, you know. I mean, what a bore. Yes, but anyhow, how many forests are there left that belong to the people that they could just go and escape their crazy lives? You know, and these people are saying, forget about the forest. We're going to create thousands of jobs. Conservationists are in revolt over the damage they fear such a huge gambling mecca would do to the pristine publicly owned woodlands surrounding the Tuxedo site in Orange County. That's upstate New York in the Catskills. Also, they're warning that a casino close to the city would create tremendous devastation to the forest. However, again, it says in the article, it's estimated to generate $400 million in state and local taxes, much of it for education. Schools are always starved for money and teachers. And the company also has proposed to turn over another 6% of its slot machine revenue, a projected $30 million a year, to benefit New York State parks. So they're going to destroy... This is sound like Vietnam. We destroyed the village in order to save it. So they're going to destroy a tremendously beautiful park, but they're going to donate money to benefit New York State parks. You figure that one out. Skipping ahead in the article, they're talking about what a gold mine, literally, figuratively, what a gold mine a casino could be. The highest grossing casino in America is not in the Nevada desert, on the beaches of Atlantic City, or in the woods of eastern Connecticut, where Foxwoods Casino is. It is a hardscrabble neighborhood near Kennedy Airport in Queens, in New York City, where in 2001, Genting, the same company, opened Resorts World, New York, alongside Aqueduct Racetrack's Rusty Grandstand. Now it says, step inside the casino's soaring lobby with its three-story chandelier and two shiny Cadillacs advertising the latest giveaway, the audible hum-ding buzz of electronic slot roulette and baccarat machines signals the real action just up the escalators. At 3 p.m. on a steamy New York weekday, 4,000 men and women have parked themselves in air-conditioned comfort in front of these video screens, betting and mostly losing as much as $50 a game. Their numbers double or triple by nightfall. This place is making crazy money, said a young emergency room nurse from Mill Basin, Brooklyn, who declined to give his name, but said he came twice a week, spending as much as $600 a trip. Where do you get that money? I won $2,000 once, he said. Then you put it right back. That's right. That's exactly what happens. Anyhow, they want to build this casino. And the at its promotional office, let's see, environmentalists say that I think it would be the undoing of a lot of our work, said Mary Irizarry, 82, widely regarded as the matriarch of the decades-long movement to turn what was once a privately owned forest, where developers wanted to build housing, into a 22,000-acre state park instead. They have filed a lawsuit. She said, the existing Tuxedo Ridge Ski Center and Renaissance Fair are minor nuisances, she said, at her cottage 5 minutes from the proposed casino site, a resort that promises to draw 19,000 people a day, every day, is another matter. And the National Resources Defense Council and New Jersey Sierra Club have come out against the project, saying it threatens the watershed that supplies drinking water for both states. It took $100 million to buy Sterling Forest and turn it into public land, said Carol Ash, a longtime conservationist. It is inappropriate to now say they are going to put the equivalent of a new city in the middle of a forest. They'll destroy it, of course, no matter whatever this company says. In the same newspaper, on the same day, right next to that article, is another article. It says, boom in energy spurs industry in the Rust Belt. A real game changer. Oil and gas production lifts many sectors in decaying cities. Youngstown, Ohio. And it just goes on to say that there's a tremendous turnaround now because of fracking for oil and gas in these places. And it's supplying a huge number of jobs, construction jobs, well digging jobs, and disposal jobs, whatever else. Of course, the fracking is destroying the watershed. It is destroying people's wells. It's creating all kinds of tremendously fatal illnesses and other health concerns. But there it is. And it's supplying a huge number of jobs and gainful employment, sometimes very well-paid employment, for a lot of people here who don't have jobs. So it's a complex issue. It's a complex issue. But to me, it seems that this is, what is the opposite of farsighted, I guess, nearsighted, right? So they want to build a gigantic gambling casino upstate, destroy a forest, inevitably, and attract whatever else gets attracted by gambling casinos. There will be drug sales, there will be prostitution. It'll turn the whole area within a 50-mile or a 100-mile diameter, it'll turn circumference, whatever the word is. It'll just destroy the culture there. It'll destroy the forest, absolutely everything. But the state needs money. So far, Governor Cuomo in New York State has decided that he's put a temporary ban on fracking in New York State. But the Marcellus Shale formation, which is being used in Pennsylvania and other places to provide natural gas and, I guess, in some cases, oil, extends way into New York, into the forest and upstate New York. So if fracking started there, it would be quite something, right? I mean, and everybody knows that fracking destroys the water, it destroys people's health. So here's these two things right next to each other. To me, they both seem, and I mentioned the complex issue, right? If you live upstate and you don't have a job and you can't take care of your family and you're in poverty, it's no joke. So these things are really like a gold mine has suddenly been struck. So I'm not I'm not, you know, it's a complex issue. But to me, you combine the two things. They're basically raping the earth and destroying the earth, the air, the land, and the water, both of these places. For what? What is that? Can they not find something else? I know the country needs energy. People need jobs. The government, state governments and local governments need taxes. I cannot supply the answer. I suppose many people could. But it's sad when gambling, which basically is drawing a tremendous amount of money from people who hardly have any, people who live on Social Security, who are working at regular jobs, spending $50, $80, $100 a day, maybe $200, $300 a day, maybe more money. I don't know where the money comes from. I have no idea where they get this money from. There are people who live on small fixed incomes. The emergency, the EMI technician, EMS technician, he works in an ambulance. How much does he get paid? How much does he get paid? He's spending $600 a week. I really don't get it. But basically, people who know about gambling, and if you've ever gambled, which I have at one point in my life, I was, I guess, not addicted to gambling, but I was thrilled and fascinated by gambling. And this is a time when, interestingly enough, I had nothing else to do. I had money. I had an inherited money. This is decades ago from my parents. And I owned a couple of buildings. Yes, yes, yes. I was a landlord. And money came in, and I didn't have to work. And I wasn't doing anything creative. I wasn't doing anything really meaningful day after day after day. And I had this money coming in, and I decided to go gamble in various places. And so I have some familiarity with this. And it's a famous saying about gambling addiction, and it is an addiction for people who do it all the time, that people gamble to lose. They don't gamble to win. Professional gamblers who know what they're doing, or people who cheat, you know, the casinos, and the casinos employ people to detect these professional, cheaters. But those are few, the professional gamblers. The regular gamblers, the amateur gamblers, and people who are addicted to it, they gamble to lose because they can't stop. And since the odds over the long term, even the short term, but especially over the long term, are with the house, I don't know what the different odds are. The best odds are blackjack, which I think is 52-48. 52% of the time the house will win, and 48% of the time you might win. So the house, you keep playing and playing and playing, you're going to lose eventually, and the house is going to win. And the house always wins. And people who gamble keep gambling. People who have nothing else to do, or nothing else that their lives, nothing else that gives them a thrill in their lives. There's gambling can be absolutely thrilling. But what is gambling? Gambling is like a lot of other addictions, but it's one of the most, obviously there's greed, there's desperation, there's self-destruction. People gamble to lose. It's self-destructive behavior, sort of like destroying the land, the air, and the water to have as much temporary energy as possible for people because they need energy. It's not looking toward any kind of replanting of trees or sustainable energy production. It is just merely taking what's in front of you in a desperate, grasping way, right? Grasping, said the Buddha. It's like taking and grasping this stuff and not putting anything back, not thinking about what the future will be, because people feel like there is no future and they are bored to death. And in some cases, the realistic part is they need jobs. But maybe all this is inevitable, because there are too many people in the world, and there, we've used up the land. People, there are huge farms and corporations, gigantic corporations own all the farms. That's a different world, and too many people need too much food. They need too much energy, but nothing comes from gambling. Nothing constructive is produced. Yes, there are jobs, right? But there's nothing coming from it. It's just a church of desperation. It is the great church of desperation and greed and grasping. And I've gambled before, and you can become addicted to the thrill and the hope and the fear. But in the end, what you're doing is just basically hurting yourself. It's the same as anything like drinking, drugs, sex, you know, violence. Look at the Navy SEALs, the people who volunteer to become trained Navy SEALs. That's the ultimate gamble. They risk their lives. That's the thrill they get. Their lives are apparently so, yeah, forget the patriotism. Give me a break, all right? Their lives are apparently so meaningless or scary. I mean, what are they running from? What are they running to? Their lives are apparently so deadly boring and black to them. And then there's such an abyss in their lives that the only way they can fill it is by risking their lives, oddly enough. So that's the ultimate gamble, you know. And my father was like this. But I mean, anything like drugs, sex, violence, and business, you know, a high-risk business, crime, burglary, con games. People do all sorts of things to keep life from being routine or boring. And we could all understand that. I mean, life can be very boring and dull. And if you have a routine, let's say you have a job where you're doing something that you don't enjoy even at all, and you just have to keep going there and going there, and you go home and you have the same thing, you watch the same TV shows, you do the same thing. If you don't create something in your life which is interesting, if you don't find some value to your life or some meaning, then life is threatens to be very dull and boring all the time. My father was absolutely addicted to danger and speed. My father used to drive around. I was in a car with him a couple of times. He would drive around. We drove up in the mountains a few times in various places, even overseas in Turkey once. He used to drive up in the mountains, and he would drive around these very narrow mountain roads way high up. If you dared to look over the side, it was a big, long drop like the Adirondacks, you know, mountains. And he would drive. He would just step on the gas and hit the horn. If he was coming up or coming down. And whoever else it was had better squeeze over to the side one way or the other, because he wasn't, you know, it was the ultimate game of chicken, and he was not going to do that. And he used to speed all the time. My father loved to speed. He'd buy, like, fancy foreign cars, used, because he couldn't afford, you know, really new ones because he had a lot of expenses. But He used to speed all the time. He'd go 90 miles an hour, 100 miles an hour in his car when he was down south on back roads. He was addicted to danger. He was even, when he worked as an engineer all over the world, he worked for the Agency for International Development, or whatever it's called. But it was basically rife with spies. The CIA sort of subcontracted spying work. So my father spied in South America, in places where the border of India and Pakistan was, where Turkey and Russia. He was always on the border. He loved danger. He loved spying. And I guess I've had some of that, except that I grew up with my mother, who never took one single risk in her life, who was afraid of everything and never risked anything and did the same thing in the same way every day. So she was, doing a routine. And my father was traveling all over the world, risking everything all the time. And this is definitely not Buddhism we're talking about, not the middle way.
And whatever comes our way, yeah, darling, go make it happen. Take the world in a loving embrace. Fire all of your guns and constant, explode into space. I like smoking lightning, heavy metal thunder, racing with the wind. We can climb so high, I never wanna get.
Now, depending where you are in your life right now, that could be just like a lot of awful noise. But if you grew up in the 60s, that's the kind of thing that and I got my first car, naturally used car, in 1962, and had various other ones since they all broke down since they were so used. But what you would get a car, you know, and you're like in your you're in your late teens or in your early 20s, and you get out on the highway and you put on this kind of music. And I think this is something that's been common to everybody, every generation that's had cars. They just speed, and people, you know, I forget about drinking and driving, but just put on that music. Do you remember that? And you could feel it even now, right? I mean, you can recall how it feels to put that, to get in a car and stomp on the gas and get out. And if you were lucky, once I had a convertible, you put the top down. It's like 2 a.m, right? You're 22 years old. You're never going to die. You're immortal. And you just, you know, made a 100-mile trip someplace, and you're going to make a 100-mile trip back after you had, you know, a couple of tacos someplace or maybe some fries and a burger. I mean, it's like there was no, if you didn't have, and a lot of people weren't working regularly in those days. It was a time of hippies and, you know, changing culture. And you got that thrill, that tremendous thrill of stepping on the gas and going 70, 80, 90 miles an hour. Yeah, sometimes the cops got you and it was bad, but most of the time you could get away with it, right? And you put the music on, it goes with it. And that music is a perfect example of the kind of thrill involved. And really what you're doing is risking your life and anybody else who's in the car with you. But it doesn't matter because the thrill is tremendous. Now, I don't know if that's a function of being young and, you know, hormones, or if it's just certain people who did that. And I'm sure there were some people who didn't speed like that. When I had a car and I was that age, I used to speed all the time. Other people are different. Once my uncle, I had a rich uncle, his name was Uncle Ed, and he was a real prick. may he not rest in peace. And this guy, I'll tell you a story about him some other time, and why I would say just an extreme thing. But this guy offered, when I graduated from high school, he offered to buy me a brand new car, right? There was always a price tag attached to these things with this guy, but, you know, that's another story. But he offered to buy me a brand new car, as long as it was a Nash Rambler. Now, a Nash Rambler, it's 1960, whatever it was, 18, I'm not good at math. But anyhow, it's the early 60s. And they're a Nash Rambler, they don't exist anymore, and they haven't for decades. A Nash Rambler, I don't know if there's an equivalent for it right now. When I look at the car commercials on TV, I don't see that. But a Nash Rambler was a car that you might want to get buried in. You know, it was like a box, and it was made especially for safety. And only old people who didn't want to go more than 22 miles an hour, even on a highway, drove Nash Ramblers. It was famously a car for timid old people because it was supposed to be so safe. And this is what he insisted on buying me. And I told him, well, you know, why don't you just give me the money and I'll buy some other car. You want to buy me a car? He said, no, I want you to have this car because it's the kind of car that's safe for you. And I don't want you driving around like all these other teenagers, you know, getting on the highway and stomping on the gas and maybe hurting yourself and other people. So I told him to go stuff it. You know, he could keep his car. And I had to, you know, wait a couple of years till I worked part-time at various jobs to save up enough money to buy my first broken-down used car, which blew up one day or something, what they all did. But so this had nothing to do. This car was the opposite of that. This is what happens when you get older, right? People become timid and afraid when they get older, and they become cautious for generally pretty good reasons. I mean, you know, their health is precarious. Their reflexes are slow. They're not able to indulge in these kinds of dangerous behavior. But when I was a kid, I used to do this stuff all the time. And just like gambling, it was, in fact, gambling with your life. I remember once there was a tremendously bad hurricane. This was back in the 60s when I had a car, actually, not his car, another car that I bought, a used car. And this was there was a huge hurricane out in Rockaway, sort of like Hurricane Sandy, only the winds were much worse. And the bay, there was a big bay there, and it met the ocean. It was going to meet the ocean, swamping all the land in between, which is where a lot of people lived. And I had, my family had a little bungalow, a little tiny wooden shack out there. Probably, you know, these things used to burn up like matchsticks all the time. But I drove out there when the hurricane was blowing almost at its hardest. I drove out there when everybody else, the cops, were telling everybody to evacuate the place. And they were arresting people who didn't evacuate, and they were kicking everybody out to protect people's lives. I drove out there, parked my car, and walked down to the beach when there was a hurricane. And the waves were crashing in, huge high waves were crashing in. The wind was blowing like mad. And I went out on the beach. There was nobody else out there, you know, and I was just sort of standing there in the face of this tremendous wind. It was like a giant beast with the water coming all the way across from Africa. Talk about 3,000 miles of cold Atlantic water smashing into whatever small little jetties they had there and into the beach and, you know, and the water and getting higher and higher and higher. What did I think I was doing? Well, clearly, that was self-destructive, crazy self-destructive behavior. The cops finally grabbed me off the beach and said, you better get out of here right now. We're going to wind up arresting you. But we don't have the time to do it. So just, you know, get out. So I drove out of there. I mean, I used to, when I climbed trees, I used to climb as high as I could, even to branches that could hardly even hold me. And even in my not so long ago days, I used to do performing on stage. Performing is like working without a net, doing live performing monologues where you memorize, you know, a story. And sometimes you just spontaneously do things like what I'm doing right now is it's risky in a way because and it could easily be you could wind up doing something which is boring or strange or something would come out of your mouth and who knows. And you might get it wrong or you might not get have a coherent, interesting, entertaining segment that you're doing. So it's not like I have a script that I'm reading from or like I had a script when I stood up on stage. So I've always been involved with risking things. And now, like a lot of older people, and especially since I've had some really serious illnesses in the last several months, I've grown timid and I'm not really that that risky about things anymore. But once when I had money coming in and I wasn't really doing anything, I think that may be the key. There was no creative meaning to my life and I wasn't doing any kind of work which was helping other people or creating anything. I used to go down to casinos because casinos provide this tremendous thrill and this danger. I went to a place in the Bahamas called Paradise Island. I don't know what its actual name is, but it was called Paradise Island. And basically it was just the whole island subsisted on this giant casino that was down there. There were two casinos. And then I went out to Las Vegas. I went down to San Juan in Puerto Rico a couple of times and gambled. I went to Atlantic City, which was extremely sordid. I mean, that was really incredibly sordid. Did you ever see that film Atlantic City? I think it was called Atlantic City, Burt Lancaster. just nasty. I mean, the mob controlled all the casinos in the worst possible way, and the place was filled with poverty and broken down buildings and cracked up streets, and it was just nastiness, and it was cold. I went down in the winter one time, it was cold. But you go into the casino, any casino, Las Vegas, especially a place like Las Vegas or Atlantic City, there's no day or night. There's no day or night. You don't have to go to bed at a certain time. You don't have to eat what you usually eat. You don't have to do what you usually do. You don't have to take out the garbage. You know, you have a room, and you could do anything. Even if you're married, you go down there, and who knows? It's a world without rules. It's a world without inhibitions. Everything is completely, as the people in the helping profession say, everything is disinhibited, you know? When you walk in there, you're not a paralegal, you're not a plumber's assistant, you're not an emergency service technician. You're James Bond when you walk into those places. And the lighting is really beautiful, absolutely beautiful, and it's exciting. There's this buzz, and like the slot machines, bells are going off and whistles are going off, and you can hear people screaming that he won, you know, they won, and the silver dollars are pouring out of the slot machine. And then I used to play blackjack. That was my caution. That was my cautionary side, because blackjack was 52-48, so you could win fairly often. And if you played conservatively, but where's the fun in that? You know, I mean, why gamble if you're going to be conservative? The two things just don't go together. But I was conservative. I mean, I tried to have it both ways, which is the worst thing in the world to do. You try to have something both ways, and you get split down the middle, and you don't even know who you are. If you're going to gamble, gamble. If you're going to be conservative, don't take any risks. You know, pick one or the other. There is no middle way here. So, you know, you go down. I used to go down there with just a certain amount of money that I could afford to lose. But that's not real gambling. I mean, what real gamblers do is they go down there and they have, they got the deed to their house. They got their right to sell their children. They will cash in anything to make a big score. And of course, they inevitably, the more they do it, wind up losing. But it's not what you're going to get. The gambling is not about winning, and the gambling is actually about losing. But what it really is at bottom is about a thrill and a fear that people, they're cops and firemen. I don't know, a lot of them do gamble, but they don't really need to gamble. I mean, if you have a job where you put your life on the line all the time, or professionals like special ops troops or something, I mean, that's really gambling, right? You know, put your life on the line, risk your life all the time. You would think that people like that wouldn't gamble, but I know people like that do gamble, right? They gamble all the time. So I guess people like that, or people like, you know, not all of them, obviously, but a lot of people who join professions or are in professions like that, where there's tremendous risk, where life and death are, you know, at risk, they are so completely infected by this. That even in their downtime, even in the lulls between risking their lives and gambling their lives, they gamble. They gamble a lot. They gamble all the time. They go to casinos. They play poker for stakes, you know, all the time. So, but I would go down there, and so I was this strange combination of. You know how, playing cards, sometimes it looks like they have two faces on playing cards. Is that, they have two faces on playing cards. That's how I was. So you see the old face of comedy, Janus, is it? Comedy and tragedy. I would go down there and I was conservative and I was taking risks all at the same time. And did I think I was James Bond? Me, you know, with my, ill-fitting cheap cotton shirt and my I even had a sport jacket I wore, and anybody who knows me probably has never seen me in a sport jacket, even if they know me for 60 years already. But I wore a little sport jacket and I had a cotton shirt, and I thought I was James Bond. I was down there, and I would sit at the blackjack table. I didn't like roulette, because roulette, I'm sneering, roulette is really, truly a sucker's game. I mean, the odds in roulette, unless you're going to play, be conservative, you put it on red or you put it on black. Well, you know, Eventually, I don't know what the odds are there. Maybe they are even. Maybe the odds are even on there. But people, inevitably, when they're playing, they bet more and more. If they win, they keep betting it all, and they bet it all, and they put it on. And you get more chips, you just push them all on, red or black. And then, but that's not really gambling. That's just kind of like putting your toe in the water. But people who gamble on roulette and they put it on a number, you know, one, is it 33? I forget. It's one out of 33 numbers, maybe, yeah, I think that's it, something like that, or 30 numbers. And what are the odds? The odds are tremendous against you winning. But people, if they win one time, they gamble more and more and more. But I used to love the blackjack table, because the lights were shining down, bright, warm lights, and there was a thrill and a danger to it. And the dealer had this, they had this steely, strange, mysterious, challenging look on their face. They weren't supposed to encourage anybody, and they weren't supposed to discourage anybody. They had this deadpan poker face, to use a certain phrase. And they, you had to play against, I won't go into the details of blackjack, but, the cards would come across this beautiful curved green table, like a pool table, only with certain decorations on it. And people sit next to you, and you, there's room, of course, for a drink in front of you. And the casino loves for you to drink a watered down drink as much as you can, because it fuddles your mind. You can play, you can gamble better if your mind is sharp and concentrated, and you can gamble conservatively, or you could just gamble, you could just gamble in a manic sort of a way. But the cards, the dealer takes the cards, he gives cards to himself, he gives you one that's down, and then he gives you one that's up. Nobody knows, he doesn't know, but you know, because you can see it, so you know what you've got. And I think the gambler, it's called 21. The alternate name for blackjack is 21. If you go over 21 in terms of points, you lose if you go over 21. So if you had, let's say, a jack and you had all picture cards are 10. So queen, king, and jack are 10. And if you had a 10 and a 4 and then you get an 8, that's it. You're out. But you might get a 7. You would get 21, and then you would get an extra amount of chips. And if you get a blackjack, then a blackjack is an ace. I'm sorry, I'm going to throw it in. An ace and a picture card. An ace and a picture card, black, because an ace can be 1 or it can be an 11. And so I would love to play. I love to play blackjack. And people get, if you're winning, and the cards, you know, so they look at you, and the dealer looks at you, and he says, how many you want, you know, taps his fingers or something, and he snaps the card or slides it across to you, and looks at you, you know, looks at the next person, and you look at his cards to see. If he goes over 21, he's lost, and he can stick at 15, I think it's 15, and if you can get 16 or 17, you beat his hand. So it's all a gamble. It's a risk. And you don't know what's going to happen. You absolutely don't know what's going to happen. And I love to do this. And if you're in good shape if you got a picture card. Because if you got two of them, you could gamble twice. You take the king and you separate it from like the jack. And then you can have two hands. You can play. It's like playing two hands against the dealer. It's extraordinary. And that's, then you start to lose it. I mean, there's something about the manic thrill of it. And one time I remember I was, this is to show you the the tremendous schizophrenia that I always carry around with me. I went down to the casino in Puerto Rico, in San Juan. Never mind. This is, what could I say, I was pre-political? Never mind about statehood and the fact that there's people, you know, steeped in poverty there. I just had extra money. I had nothing better to do with my life. And I went down and I stayed in a hotel, and you just go downstairs. And like I say, there's no night or day. You go downstairs and 24 hours a day, the roulette wheel is going. The slot machines are going. People are gambling. And you might never leave there. You get off the plane, you take a cab to the hotel, and you don't even leave the hotel, not even to walk around the city, to go to the beach, to take a tour of the island, to just sit in a restaurant. I mean, some people do that, but a lot of people, like what I did, is to just go there because I wanted to live in a fairy tale world where there was no night or day. And I remember one time, and here's how it works. If you're winning, if you win one hand after another, and the chips pile up, Now, I sat at a cheap table. Also, I used to get cheap chips, maybe $10 chips, $5 chips, and $10, $20 at the most. I mean, you could get, $500,000 chips. And I would sit there and I would gamble. So I never lost too much or won too much. But one time I had a run. It happens once in a while. You just get a run of luck. And luck is the word. It's all based on luck. There is no knowing what's going to happen. You could win 10 hands in a row, and then suddenly you could lose, and then it would all be gone. Because what you do is you have a tendency, if you're winning, to keep, and you say, well, I'm on a roll here, right? You keep pushing the winnings in. But what I did often is, if I was winning, I would take the extra money I was winning on top of the money I had brought down there to gamble with, and put that in my pocket like a little timid bunny, right? And I would hold on to the money, and then I would get the thrill of gambling with the extra money that I brought down, right? So if you make back the money, or you still have as much money that you brought down, then you play with the house's money, because if you're winning extra money, it's not like you're losing anything. All of this is all a delusion. Basically, you're playing to lose. And I remember one time I was winning and winning and winning, and I had $600 in chips. Now, this was back a ways. So right now that would be like $1,500 to $2,000 in chips. And what happens when you're winning and you win, other people, because they're all looking to be around luck because it like rubs off on you. Some people will actually touch you for luck. Or literally, they'll pat you on the shoulder or pat you on the head or just touch you for luck. If you're winning, everybody gathers around you and you feel like you're a star, like a celebrity. But all you got to do is lose. All you got to do is lose. And all of a sudden, everybody disappears. And I remember when I was winning and winning and winning, I was surrounded by people. And then what happens is if you win enough, somebody gives somebody else a signal who gives somebody else a signal, and some woman dressed in practically nothing walks up next to me and offers me a drink on the house. And if you keep winning, they offer you another drink on the house so that you start making mistakes. Between the sexual allure and the promise of something and who knows what and the alcohol, you're completely gone. You have no way of knowing exactly what's happening or, how to play. You can't figure it out. And you start making mistakes. And sure enough, after that, I just lost. And everybody disappeared. Everybody who was standing around me, practically applauding because I was winning and making me feel like I was James Bond or the king of the world, I turn around and they're completely gone. All of a sudden, you're a piece of dog turd if you lose, because that's how superficial and ephemeral and meaningless this whole endeavor is, right? It's all based on this desperation and greed. And other people, if they see that you're lucky, they gather around you to basically suck your luck out of you like vampires. But if you start to lose, then they don't want anything it's like you have leprosy. They don't want to be anywhere near you. It's the most extraordinary experience. And I did this a few times, but I used to feel sick to my stomach. But here's an example of how conservative I was. One time I was gambling, and it was down in San Juan. I went there two or three times. I was gambling, and I won a lot of money. So what I did was I took the money that was extra money that I won and kept it to gamble some more and took the money I had brought down there, which was $500. I went out in the middle. It was like 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I went out where there was a United States post office in the lobby, bought a money order made out to myself and mailed it back to myself in New York City. I mean, really, is that gambling? I don't know. I mean, there's all kinds of gambling, I guess. But it shows the two sides of my nature, anyhow, that I would send back this this money order to myself, and then I gambled with the extra money, which I wound up losing. Tell me again, how much time do I have? Oh, okay. The thrill of it, the absolute thrill of it. And I also, a couple of times I played the slot machines, and there is something about that. You know, if you've seen slot machines before in the movies, if you've never gambled, you've seen in the movies, they have, you know, seven, they have bars, they have symbols, they have numbers. And if it comes up three in a row, then you win. And a siren goes off, a light, you know, like a light on top of a bubble on top of a detective's car or a police car, you know, it'll go off. And same thing, everybody gathers around you, they applaud, you know, but the most awful thing is to see the people who are playing at slot machines. They sit there, usually a lot of older people, and they have these giant buckets of quarters or dollar or silver dollars. And now I'm sure a lot of it is electronic, which to me takes a lot of the tactile thrill out of it. Because when you're gambling with the cards, these are, you know, they're new decks. They're not bent or twisted or the same cards you recognize because you play with your friend Bobby, you know, at his house in the kitchen table. Because I used to play poker once in a while for nickels, dimes, and quarters. It's not the same deck where you could even, you know what you're going to get because you recognize the back of the card. It's been so creased in a certain way for so long. These are brand new shiny cards, and that's part of the thrill, too. You know, the seven comes, and it's not just a seven. It's magnified in a way, in some kind of delirious, manic way. The numbers are magnified. The light shines on it. It's, you know, it's on the green table. And the card, which is slick, and it seems that they all seem to be alive, these cards. And if you get a king, a queen, and a jack, they, you know, and then there's a, God knows, you get even to the depths of psychology. You get the queen, who is the mother. The king is the father. And the jack, if you're a male, the jack is you. Funny, there's no princess, right? Why is there no Ms. Jack? Why is there a king, a queen, and a jack? This never occurred to me before. Why are there not four picture cards? I guess it just doesn't work out. Who knows how these things developed? But there's no princess. There's only a prince. That the jack is a prince. When the picture cards come, you have a chance of winning or splitting so that you can gamble twice. And the picture cards come out and everybody, you know, it's a great feeling. So it's the thrill. There's a thrill. But when I think back on it now, the gambling thrill was in place of an emptiness. And it's the same, to me, it's the same thing. It was in place of an emptiness. Later on when I had real troubles and risks. I mean, after all, what's more of a gamble? I mean, that's just gambling with cards and money. You know, yeah, it's an addiction, and yeah, it's a serious thing. And you can see on a larger scale, it provides, you know, all kinds of jobs for people, but it destroys the environment. It definitely destroys the cultural, emotional, moral, and physical environment of any place where there's gambling, right? It's nothing but gambling. When you go there, you're living in a delusional world, a manic delusional world, where only people who own these places, the house, they make the money. A lot of them don't gamble at all. They wouldn't even gamble. They know better than to do that, than to risk their lives. They're making money. It's a business for them. But what is gambling? Gambling is, why do people do these things? Why do people take these risks? Why do people drive so fast? Why do people risk their lives jumping from helicopters, you know, volunteer for SEAL, Navy SEAL duty, jumping from helicopters in the middle of the night to attack some kind of armed camp? Why do they do this? Why do people speed? Why do people break into houses when people are asleep, when anything could happen? Why do people grab a loaded gun and stick it in somebody's face in a back alley somewhere and risk their lives and risk killing somebody else? Why do people hijack trucks? Why do people do these things that involve risk and danger and the fact that they could pay a tremendous price, either prison or their lives or losing all their money? And this is not like there's a different kinds of addiction. There's like, you know, heroin addiction. There's alcoholism. These things are to keep people from feeling, but I think it's all connected at the bottom. These things are to keep people from feeling too much danger and too much. If you feel threatened all the time, you'll drink or you'll take downer type of things or you'll take pills like euphorics. But at the bottom, these things are all connected like roots in a forest. They're all entangled, which is that there's something chasing you. There's something chasing you. What is chasing you? Ennui, boredom. Is it mortality that's chasing you, that you're afraid of in a way, that you have to fill it up? What are you chasing, and what's chasing you in gambling? And then speaking of the entire culture, what is it that this culture is for anymore? What does it mean anymore? Why are we absolutely just raping the earth, making people sick, because we need more and more and more energy to light up 5,000 football stadiums at night, to light up gigantic skyscrapers day and night, to provide off-track vehicles or whatever they're called, you know, so that you can drive around the desert and destroy what environment is left and kill every animal in your path. You see all those car commercials. Why? What are people? What is this whole culture escaping from, that it's addicted to television and to little screens in front of their faces? And what is this addiction all about? What is everybody trying to run from? And what is everybody running to? I'm just asking these questions. I don't know the answer. To me, it feels like there's a certain sense of meaninglessness. If there's a hollowness and an emptiness in your life, if it feels like it's going to swallow you up, then you will do anything. You will do anything. You will risk anything to keep from falling into it. And I think that's where the risk comes from. That's where the urge to gamble with anything. But, you know, life itself is a gamble. You don't need to do all this stuff. Man, if you get married, what a gamble. Getting married to another human being, try to live with another human being, forget about it. And having kids who get sick, who maybe, you know, could get hurt or something awful could happen to them. There is nothing more scary than when your kid gets really sick and has to go to the hospital or gets a really high fever. Nothing in my life has ever been so scary as that you might lose your kid or that you fall in love with somebody. That's a gamble. Life itself is a gamble. So here we are in New York State, gambling on the environment, gambling on destroying our land, our water, gambling on everything, because there is no, to me, there's no central core of meaning in our culture anymore. I mean, there's no point in even being here anymore. What's the point of America? What is the point of having a life here anymore in America? Just to get the job, just to, you got to stay alive. Like I said, it's a complex issue. You got to stay alive. The state needs taxes to educate people. But what is the point of all this greed and desperate gambling with the earth, with the air, with the water? I don't know, but it's all connected in some way. It's all connected.
And his command. Well, you don't.